Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Katie Schaefer to discuss The Eyes of the Dragon. And I do want to note that this book initially came out in 1984, but since it was first published as a limited edition slipcase hardcover, I went ahead and went with the mass market date, which was in 1987. So that was the first time, you know, it was widely available and anyone who wanted to read it could read it. But Katie, this is one of Stephen King's books that kind of takes you by surprise, to say the least. And I was not expecting a book like this from Stephen King.
No, neither was I. It's just, it's so outside of his wheelhouse. But that those are his books that I love to read the most, to see what he can do other than like his standard horror stuff.
And to be fair, it did take him a while before he really decided to dive into something this different. You know, by even 1984, he had written so many other things. And as you and I both know, over the years, he's only written more and more and sort of strayed from the horror path, I would say, more than usual. Like, some of his stories aren't as horror driven as others. And obviously the Dark Tower series, which this does kind of sort of tie into, you know, there are some connections there. That's a series that has some horror elements to it, but really doesn't thrive off of the horror necessarily. There's a much bigger story there, I would say. And then you have new things like the Mr. Mercedes trilogy, which has been turned into a show. I haven't read those though, but I know those are like more along the detective lines.
Right. Hard-boiled mysteries.
Yeah. I'm sure there's still plenty of horrific things happening in those though, yes, because it is Stephen King. But, you know, I've just seen through what I've read how he has changed things up every now and then. And I think it's important for writers to do that, much in the same way it is for artists and musicians to not just produce the same thing over and over and over again, because fans will get tired of that. Some fans won't. Some fans want bands to just sound the same forever. And, you know, I don't see the fun in that, but that is besides the point. With The Eyes of the Dragon, you know, this is very fantasy medieval. And honestly, I don't care for the medieval setting. I think this is a story that, because of how character driven it is, it would have worked in any setting, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, I first thought of, you know, if this were the story of a mob family, it would work just as well.
Right. That is a good perspective to take on that. I think it's, I like high fantasy. So for me, I was like, oh, this is interesting. But it's definitely, it's medieval-esque, because there's some stuff in it that is very not medieval.
Right.
And that, I liked that part. I would have liked it if he had pushed it more in like the weird direction, like it is in The Dark Tower, because this is set in like the same world universe type thing. Like Delane is, they mention the country of Delane. So I would have liked it a bit more if they'd gone further with it, but I think it's an interesting idea. Very interesting. And how he writes it with the narrator, that was also unexpected. He doesn't usually, I don't know if I've seen that in any of his other work.
Yeah, let's dive into the story, because I think at the heart of it, it's a story about a family, but it's also a story of betrayal. And someone is wrongly accused of that betrayal, which happens to be, you know, the king's son.
Right. So the heir apparent.
Yes. So it's this huge ordeal for just everyone in the entire, you know, realm of Delane. It's just such a shock to all of them. And then, you know, as you and I are familiar with Roland and Flag already, you kind of know from the start, as soon as you see Flag's name, you're like, oh, this isn't going to end well.
Yes. Yep. It's like, oh, well, bad things are going to happen in horrible ways, because we know that guy.
Yeah. And they absolutely do happen in horrible ways. You have the death of Queen Sasha, which is what Peter is accused of, you know, and he sort of Well, he's not accused of that, is he?
No, nobody gets accused of that.
It's his father's death.
Yes, his father's death is what he gets wrong accused parent. Of. Yes. No, if like that particular story of how Queen Sasha dies, I was like, well, that's horrific in its simplicity.
Just, yes.
Oh, that was bad. But yeah, Peter is accused of killing his father with the poison. And, you know, we know from the start that that's not true. There's no point where we think Peter is guilty of it, but it's interesting to watch how it spreads throughout the country.
Yeah, and we come to find that Flag was the one involved in Queen Sasha's death as well. You have Flag behind all of this, and you have Thomas as a witness to the father's death. But he sort of has this tension with Peter because Peter is sort of the perfect son. And Thomas is just living in his shadow, basically. And obviously, when you get into the hierarchy of who is going to become king and all of that that comes with it, you know, Thomas sort of feels like the forgotten child, in a sense, until he is crowned king. And once that happens, you can tell he doesn't really know what he's doing because things just start to
unravel.
Very different. Yes, they unravel, and Flag is obviously, you know, guiding him along. He tells him about, you know, these different places in the castle that he didn't know about before, and that's how he actually ends up witnessing the murder of Roland. And it's just one of those things where you can tell how devious Flag is from the start. So it makes me glad that this book wasn't super long.
Yes.
Because I feel like knowing what the readers know right away, I don't think Stephen King could have dragged that out much longer than this book was, because yeah, it just would have become too much.
Yes. The pacing, I think, is fairly well done in that things move along at a very brisk pace. You know, events unfold fairly evenly. At no point did I feel like, okay, well, let's get to the point. What's going to happen next? Because and things go so badly and so fast that, and yet you still feel time has passed in the story. You know, the 5 years or so that he says takes place between the imprisonment and then the final denouement of the book are felt in the story, but we don't have to linger over it, which was nice. I did think that the ending felt rushed.
Yeah.
But it also did something. It also made it feel very much like a fairy tale, because that is how most fairy tales, I've read a lot of them, and I feel like that's how most fairy tales end. Like, when things are resolved, everything's, this happens and we're good and now we're done.
Right. Quick question for you. Do you think if Peter wasn't royalty, he would have just been killed on the spot?
In which instance?
When he's found guilty.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They say that the only reason he didn't die is because they don't kill members of the royal blood.
Right. And instead, they just put him up in the tower. And what's interesting is, you know, Thomas is only 12 when he takes over. So because he was manipulated by Flag, he gives Flag so much power. And that's when, like you said, things start unraveling, because Thomas is too young to really have any idea of what to do. You know, Peter is at least a few years older than him, I believe. And he's sort of been groomed for this pretty much his entire life.
Right. Right. Especially with that early, like, I feel like we didn't know a whole lot about Peter, whereas we do know a lot about Thomas, because we get in the beginning of the book, we get a couple of stories about Peter's relationship with his mother and the dollhouse and all of that. And then it kind of sets a standard of, this is who Peter is. He's a good guy. And then we move on to Thomas, and like the rest of the book, when it really gets into the character work, feels a lot more explanatory of why Thomas did what he did and how he hurts and all of that. And I did find it, I was like, well, no wonder that kid starts drinking at the age of 12, just drinking tons of bottles of wine a day. Like, well, you're definitely not going to make any good choices as a 12-year-old if you're doing that.
Yeah, and it seems like the only time we really get more out of Peter's story is when he requests the dollhouse.
Yes, exactly. And that feels more like it's not so much about Peter it's more about moving the story along.
Mm-hmm.
These are the machinations that this guy has to go through to get his crown back. But it feels like we kind of, Peter feels like a little more of a flat character than Thomas does. But then I did think that the most satisfying part is that final scene, the final big scene between Flag and Peter and everybody. And you get to see what kind of man he is with how he deals with the Thomas situation.
Even though Peter is in captivity, you can tell he never really gives up on getting back what is rightfully his. And you have these other characters. You have Anders Pena. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but you have some of the guards. You have Dennis, who is the butler. So you just have some of these other characters that we don't necessarily need to know a lot about, but based on their actions, we know just enough about them for their roles to make perfect sense within the bigger story.
Right, right. I totally agree. And this, each of them feels like a good variation on like not a stereotype, but on like a general type of character. An archetype. That's the word. Ha ha.
There we go.
It came to me eventually.
We're having a day today.
I know, right? Each of them feels like an archetype of that is very often seen in fairy tales and old stories and stuff like that. And it feels like he was really invested in creating something that had that feeling in it. And so even though in another Stephen King book, especially since his books are so character driven, it would feel like not enough, because usually the whole point of his books is how these people learn and grow. Whereas this one is a little bit more of, you know, very traditional good versus evil, you know, heroes and villains type of story that goes through a lot of different. Yeah, I lost the thread there, but
it's okay. I think the family dynamic is something that comes off the pages really well with this story. You really get a sense in the beginning for, you know, what it was like after the queen was killed. You know, they kind of just say she died in childbirth, basically. That's sort of the cover up, even though that's not the whole story. And then once Roland's death comes around, there's this tension because of what Thomas knows, and whether that is tension between him and Peter or even just him and Flag, who isn't really family, but he's been around long enough to sort of just fall into that category, I would say, because he worked with Roland and now he's taking over and working with the son. He's just sticking around, and he's around even more once Thomas becomes king, because he's 12 and needs, you know, a royal advisor. So just the dynamics between that small group of characters there, I think, was done really, really well.
Yes, there's lots of different points that the story can kind of ping pong between, with the tension and the conflict and, you know, betrayal. Like, there's so many different betrayals all going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of it is, that's the heart of the story. And I think that part is so well done.
Let's talk about Peter's escape, because obviously it's something that he plans for years and years and years. And then he wants the dollhouse because he knows that there is a loom in it. And he basically is getting these older napkins that people kind of wouldn't miss. And they don't have the royal, you know, little logo on them or anything like that. So he's just slowly making this rope so that he can get down from this, you know, one window or one opening that is super, super, super high up. And then he has a few people who risk their own lives to come help him. And, you know, he's not entirely sure any of this is going to work until it actually does. So there's sort of just this skepticism the whole time. You're like, wait, is he actually going to get out of this?
Yes. And that was set up so well with the will it, won't it, how's it going to go down? Because you get the sense pretty quickly that his plan is probably not going to work. And then eventually you're just kind of told flat out, like, what he's going to do. This rope is not enough. And how it was described, the logical part of my brain went, that rope would cut the shit out of his hands. He would not be able to hold on to that tiny little, if it's as thin as the book says, you know. But I think how King engineers that final scene feels very well planned. Everything is kind of laid out in this neat little pattern. And he kind of pulls the curtain back very slowly. And so it's that part of it is very satisfying, you know, especially with the napkins. I thought it was weird how the napkins thread their way through until the very, you know, the very end scene.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I really liked about the end of the book was Thomas finally coming to his senses and revealing that he knew what Flagg had done the entire time, which is probably why he started drinking at 12. You know, his brother was put away. Flagg was clearly manipulating him. And I think Thomas was smart enough to know that the entire time, but he wasn't really smart enough to know how to fix it. So he ended up becoming hated by the people of Delane. And his way to make that right is to confront Flagg, shoot him in the face, and then go off with Dennis to try and find him, because Flagg has these magical abilities and he just disappears.
Right. And I thought that was an incredibly great choice for the story, that it's Thomas who finally turns and faces him, and that it makes it's such a redemption moment that feels very good. Because, you know, I did feel as the narrator is insisting throughout the book that despite all of these terrible choices, like, Thomas is not a bad boy. He is, you know, all of these other not so good things, but in his heart, he's not a bad person. And then it totally pays that off, which would not have happened if you had gone the more traditional route of having Peter vanquish Flagg. It works so much better with Thomas. And then that he goes and he realizes he should probably get the heck out of Dodge, because, you know, a crushed people don't stand much for rulers when they reach a certain point. So I like that him and Dennis get to go off and do crazy things, which is mentioned in The Drawing of the Three,
which I am currently trying to finish up.
Yeah, I like how he ended it, even if it is a bit abrupt.
Yeah, it leaves you on a bit of a cliffhanger moment. You know, you don't really find out what happens. So we have these ties to the Dark Tower, though, like you just mentioned. It gets a mention in The Drawing of the Three, which is the second Dark Tower book. So why don't we talk a little bit more about those connections? Because Roland and Flagg are both characters who appear heavily in that series.
Right. And Roland is from Gilead, I believe. I looked it up earlier so that I would be prepared. And then and they mentioned Delane and it being close. But I kind of got the impression that this is a time, you know, hundreds or thousands of years before what takes place in the Dark Tower, that this is like a story of their, like, of, you know, the people who live in Roland's time. This is like their fairy story or whatever, because it makes so much mention of history that, oh, of course, the reader would know this.
Yeah. And you have the fact that Randall Flagg actually first appeared in The Stand, which isn't considered a Dark Tower book, but it's a great introduction to that character. So if anyone is listening to this and has not read that yet, it's lengthy, but it's definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm. Also done, great audiobook. I've listened to that one, I think, twice. And Grover Garland is the narrator, and he is does a very good job, especially with the voice of Flagg, because he is so creepy in that book and so unsettling. And it definitely has a through fare for that character, like Flagg in The Stand and Flagg in The Eyes of the Dragon and Flagg as Walter in The Dark Tower. Like, he feels the same, despite the incredibly different stories that are being told, even down to the genre they're in. This character is someone who he comes back and you can recognize him easily.
What I love is the fact that only having read The Stand and The Gunslinger before this, as soon as I saw these names, I knew right away what it meant for this story. Not necessarily that I knew King Roland was going to be killed by Flag, but it just gave me that feeling of, oh, okay, this might not tie directly into the Dark Tower, but it definitely comes from that same world. And as far as I know, like The Stand, this isn't really considered a Dark Tower series book.
Yeah, I feel like it's adjacent. This more so than a lot of the books that have some pretty significant tie-ins mm-hmm. to the Dark Tower. This one feels like it's kind of standing behind the Dark Tower, shoulder waving at you when you're reading it. You know, it's not related necessarily, but you can see it if you were standing in the Dark Tower. As a house, you could squint out the window and you could see Eyes of the Dragon over in the same neighborhood, as it were.
Yeah, I know we touched a little on the pacing of this, but I want to dive into that a little more because The Stand is a long book. The Gunslinger, not so much. Same with The Drawing of the Three. You know, those are pretty normal size books. And the same can definitely be said of The Eyes of the Dragon. And, you know, my copy was over 300 pages, but the font was pretty big in it in comparison to some of the other mass market paperbacks. So
yes,
it just felt like a much different book. And because of the fantasy elements to it, again, I think it had to be shorter than some of his other works, just because you can only take a story like this and have it go on for so long. You know, Peter could only stay up in that tower for, you know, X amount of time before we just got tired of hearing about or reading about Peter in the tower. And he's up there for many years, you know, so he does a nice job of taking this long period of time and condensing it down in a way that does not make it feel like it dragged on or that it was boring or that we just didn't care by the end of it.
Yes, you get, there's enough other material that you can, he can lace it with, which I thought he did very well with the pacing, which is, that was definitely the most Stephen King part of the book that I found, was how well he kind of layers everything together in both the past and the present. You know, it stays on the same general timeline, but he isn't afraid to take us like, okay, now we're going back to an old memory. Now we're jumping into the talk about something that happens after this. You know, he's not afraid to take this story that feels very old and then shake it up and make it his own. And that, I think, is probably what makes it the most interesting part of it to read. And the pacing is a huge part of what makes it work. Because if you had dragged it out too long, then like you said, you get bored. Like, come on, let's get with the program. But it doesn't make it so that it feels like the story takes place in, you know, the snap of a finger.
Yeah, and the fact that it's a pretty quick read too helps. You know, even some of his longer books can feel like pretty quick reads just because of how absorbed you can get in the story. You know, it took me like 2 weeks to read it, but at the same time, it didn't feel like it took me 2 weeks to read it. And I think that's when you know you have the story paced pretty well, especially for something as long as it. You know, that book is over 1,000 pages.
Right. And it is, it takes place over, you know, like 2 decades.
Right.
It spans a lot of time and there's a lot of story to tell in that book. But I agree, like it can feel like when I read it, I usually listen to it on audiobook and because I can read in the car, essentially. So it feels like it's very urgent and I get through it real quickly just because I know the story. And so I want to get to the good parts.
Right. And with The Eyes of the Dragon, you know, the same thing. There is that longer time period, but this is not a story that needs to be the length of it.
No, no.
Stephen King does have a tendency to sometimes take things maybe a step further than they need to go. And I know we've talked about epilogues of his and everything like that, but I feel like the way he paced this book and where he left it off, it was like, okay, you know, even if the quasi-medieval time period isn't totally my thing, the story was good enough for me to sort of ignore that part of the story, I guess you could say. And the way right. he left it, I was like, okay, we don't get an answer, but this is a satisfying ending.
I agree. Like, it comes quick, but I feel like it's enough. And it felt like the story, he does a really good in those last, like, I think it's like two or three pages after the final events of the main story. He does something really well in that he gives the reader a sense that the story is still continuing, even if he's not telling you about it.
Right. Well, is there anything else you want to discuss with the story or the pacing before we just talk very briefly about the TV adaptation of this that is hopefully coming soon?
I do want to say that I think this story is very simple, but very cunningly written, because it deals with very basic premises and very traditional and familiar type of story, and makes it something that's very different and interesting to read. And so it's one of the more technically skilled pieces of King's writing, I think, if you get into like just the basics of writing a good story.
Yeah. So the thing with this book is that it has actually been optioned twice.
Yep.
And now there's a third adaptation that is sort of trying to get off the ground. So first, in the early 2000s, it was supposed to be an animated film.
Oh.
And it was going to have a pretty big budget of $45 million. And obviously, we've seen animated films spend way beyond that now. But this was coming from a French company. It wasn't going to be, you know, Sony or any of the big animation companies here doing it. So you have that. It didn't come through. In 2012, Sci-Fi was developing an adaptation for, you know, the potential to air it on their channel. That did not happen. And now this
Thankfully.
Year, Hulu has announced that they are adapting the book as a TV series. So from what I can tell, they've basically optioned the book and they are going to do a pilot for it first. And then Hulu sort of decides based on that pilot if they are actually going to go through with it. So it's still not a guarantee that this is happening. And anyone who has paid attention to Stephen King's work knows how many projects are up for, you know, adaptations at any given time. There are so many. I've lost track of how many things are in progress right now between,
oh, yeah,
you know, the streaming services, the cable stuff, and the movie stuff. There's just so, so much. And then you have things like Castle Rock, which isn't a direct adaptation of anything. It's just set in the Stephen King universe. So, you know, that's on Hulu. So putting another Stephen King show on the service would definitely make sense for Hulu. You know, Netflix has done the same. Netflix has done two or three adaptations as Netflix originals, if I'm not mistaken. The two I can think of off the top of my head are Gerald's Game and 1922.
Yep, yep. And Hulu has done, what was that, 11-22?
Oh, yes, 11-22-63.
Yeah.
The date no one can actually remember.
Yeah, yeah. An important date, too, in actual history. But with James Franco. And that, I hear, did well. And was it Hulu who did where there's the big bowl over the city? I can't remember what it's called now.
I don't know. Is it Under the Dome?
Yes, that one.
Yes. I think that was actually something on network TV.
Oh, okay. Okay. Which there's also probably two or three things in development now for as well.
Yeah. And I mean, Under the Dome might be on Hulu now, but I think that was definitely a network TV show at one point, kind of like Haven, which is apparently loosely based on The Colorado Kid. But that's one where I'm like, if it's loosely based on it, do I really want to watch five seasons of it?
Yeah. Oh, and there's only so much time in life for TV.
Yeah. And, you know, as you know, this podcast is time consuming. So the more they add, the more episodes I just keep adding at the end of the list. I was like, okay, We've moved on into 2022 for me to finish this podcast.
Right. Right. And, you know, there will continuously be more. He's a well that Hollywood just keeps going back to. And his attitude has always been like, oh, sure, you want to? Sure, I'll watch this unfold and see how well it does.
Sure, give me the money.
Right? Right? Like the Dark Tower movie. Like, I was hopeful about that. And then then I watched it and I was sad.
Which is also being made into a TV series at Amazon right now. So there are so many things going on in the Dark Tower world right now. And we can pretend the movie just is not going to be a thing. I have not seen it, so I'm not looking forward to that.
As long as you know what you're expecting going in, then it's an interesting watch. It's very, you know, there's a lot of big performances that are fun to watch, including from Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey. So it's, I was just hoping it's for something thing. Good. Yeah, I was hoping for something better. So you get what you get.
Yeah, and look, I am happy to check out all of the Stephen King adaptations. You know, we're still in the 80s here, so not all of them are good. You know, I'm very aware of that by now.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, depending on your opinions on the ones that have come out in the past few years, you may think they're not good or bad. I mean, they're still making Children of the Corn movies. So
yes, I believe it is 10 and counting for Children of the Corn.
Oh, he must just be like, well, I'll just get a new car and that'll be my Children of the Corn car. Any money that I get for that, like when I get those residuals, I'll just throw it at that.
The thing is, I think with that, it's mostly student projects. So, you know, I think it's like a lot of dollar babies.
Oh, yes. Yes. Where he gives them the rights for cheapies.
Yeah.
He's like, sure, have fun.
Because I've looked at the IMDb pages for some of the later Children of the Corn movies, and I'm just like, no one has any pictures.
Yep, which is always a sign.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Katie, I know we kept this a little short here, and that's because, like I said, it was a shorter book for once, you know?
And a few illustrations, too, which still cuts down the page count.
Yes, it does. I was like, oh, look, there's pictures in this Stephen King book.
Yeah,
I was very excited about it.
Yes. And they were all like, I think he was part of getting them made and wanted them in there. And so I was like, oh, all right, this sounds good. Feels very like his homage to Tolkien, almost, with the little pictures thrown in every so often.
Yeah. And my copy of The Gunslinger, if I'm not mistaken, had little pictures drawn at like the tops of the chapters. They didn't take up full pages, but just like, start of the chapters, there would be some there. And, you know, it's a cool little thing to get these neat little visuals along with the story, because you're like, okay, you know, now we know what these characters should look like. You know, you don't have to just sort of make up your own image of them in your head while you're reading.
Right, right. It adds some nice flavor.
Yes, exactly. And Katie, I know you will be back on soon. I don't know how soon, because my schedule is crazy right now. So, you know, you're always coming on for Stephen King stuff. So I'm sure you will be back pretty soon here. And again, thank you for coming on to talk about this book.
Oh, yes. It's always fun time. And then it looks like my next one will be The Tommyknockers. So one of King's most disliked by himself books. So we'll see how that one comes out.
So I have some reading to do, because I am 2 books away from getting to that one, I would say.
Yeah, that one's not for several ones ahead, so we'll be good. We'll get it done.
Yes, and that one is a little longer, so expect that conversation to be longer too. Oof. But to our listeners, you can follow us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram, and as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.